I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, those calls to lower the political temperature lasted all 5 seconds.
It's a real threat. We all feel it. Donald Trump could actually be president again, threatening our democracy and freedoms.
Plus, why is it controversial to seek proof of citizenship before someone registers to vote? We'll discuss. And following Washington State's lead, Governor Gavin Newsom down in California has signed a bill to keep secrets from parents. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Well, it is noon on the West Coast, 3 p.m. on the East Coast. I just got off the phone with 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and I've been informed that Joe Biden is still not only the president of the United States, but he's still running to be the president of the United States again. Therefore, I have lost my steak dinner bet. And I will take Nicole and Daryl out for a very nice steak dinner, because this time last week, I did not think that Joe Biden would last another week in the race for the presidency. Now, that doesn't mean eventually he might not drop out, to be clear.
Oh, yeah. No.
But you guys said yesterday, I said, can I get out of the bet because of the assassination attempt on Trump? And that's shaking things up. You all said no. In fact, I think 100% of you told me I could not get out of that bet. So Daryl and Nicole, you two come up with a date and you let me know and we'll go get a nice steak dinner.
Deal.
All right. So after the assassination attempt on the former president, there were just, I mean, I'd call it near universal calls to lower the temperature when it comes to our political discourse in the United States. I kind of knew it wouldn't last very long. It was even shorter lived than I thought it would be. You've already seen the Donald Trump's a threat to democracy, a threat to the very fabric of our country, start to creep back into the conversation. In fact, here in Washington State, who is probably the front runner in the race to replace Bob Ferguson and be our next attorney general, just put out his latest campaign ad. Let's watch it together, shall we?
It's a real threat. We all feel it. Donald Trump could actually be president again, threatening our democracy and freedoms, including a woman's right to make her own healthcare decisions. I'm Nick Brown. As a JAG officer, prosecutor, and U.S. attorney, I've fought to protect our values. And that's what I'll do as attorney general, because I'm not afraid to take on Donald Trump or anyone who threatens who we are in Washington.
Nick Brown, Democrat for attorney general.
For the love. So a few things there. We already took down Monica Dingra's campaign. I think our reporting on Monica Dingra lying about being a prosecutor has probably nullified her chances of becoming the next attorney general. So I guess now we need to move on to Nick Brown. I have liked Nick Brown over the years. I mean, he's filled a couple different roles. He's always seemed to be perfectly reasonable, certainly not on the far, far left end of the spectrum. But this is Bob Ferguson 2.0. First of all, just a couple days after Donald Trump is almost assassinated, you're out on social media saying my first political ad of the campaign, and you start it by talking about Donald Trump being a threat to our democracy and our freedom. We already had this conversation. Nicole has reached out to Nick Brown's campaign and asked specifically, how is Donald Trump a threat to our democracy and our freedom? Like, let's be specific, and you can talk about the various ways that you believe he is a threat to the very fabric of our country and everything we hold dear. So clearly it didn't take very long for at least Nick Brown to decide that that kind of rhetoric is perfectly fine to run in a campaign. But I would also say, and I would reiterate something that I said on the show a couple weeks ago, and in fact, I wrote an op-ed about it for the News Tribune and a couple other McClatchy papers. If you read it, the headline of that op-ed, Democrats say democracy is in peril, so why don't they stand up to Bob Ferguson? I simply refuse to take seriously any Democrat in Washington State who says Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy and Republicans are a threat to our democracy, who completely ignore Bob Ferguson asking the Secretary of State of his own political party to break election law for him. You can't have it both ways. And this goes for any Republicans or any Democrats who want to act with moral hypocrisy. I said it of Republicans who acted like January 6th was no big deal. after the whole summer of ranting and raving, rightfully so, about the riots in the name of social justice across the country. And then on the flip side, Democrats ignored those riots. And then January 6th was wall to wall all over the media. It's all Democrats were talking about. So there's no moral consistency here. They're both bankrupt. Now, if Nick Brown wants to come out, I think we included this. You included this in your questions. We asked how he feels. I haven't seen him say anything publicly about it. And I could have missed it. I don't read every single tweet that Nick Brown puts out, but I feel like it would have been flagged for me had he condemned Bob Ferguson asking the Secretary of State to change the order on the ballot in the governor's race. So we asked, okay, you're talking about Donald Trump threat to democracy. How about a clear and present undercutting of democracy from the guy you're trying to replace? So it all just falls on deaf ears to me. And hopefully there are more Americans who, as these, again, the old style of pre-assassination attempt campaigning against Donald Trump is going to be the exact same as post-assassination attempt campaigning against Donald Trump. In fact, we've already seen it from Biden, who's like, well, I'm going to say it if it's true. Okay. So I hope there's more Americans who are going to see that now and start to realize that it's just unhinged. It's fear-mongering. You can absolutely criticize specific things that Donald Trump has done. You can absolutely criticize January 6th and whether you believe he was firm enough with protesters and all of that. You can absolutely, you know, criticize the actions he took after the election to try to challenge it, whatever you want. But let's be specific and let's not make these overarching claims about our democracy and everything we hold dear in peril, because that's what happens. That's what leads mentally unhinged people to pick up a rifle and try to shoot the president, the former president, in the head. So speaking of Bob Ferguson, I feel like, Nicole, we need a segment that's like, what ridiculous thing did Bob Ferguson say today?
It is every day.
We need
his
some
social
sort
media
of,
is obnoxious.
Oh my, it's and I'm sure he might run it. I don't know to the extent that gubernatorial candidates have someone who runs all of their social media pages, but it's offensive. It's bordering on offensive, because you think we're that dumb. Like when he was saying, oh, I care about public safety, it's like, no, you don't. And here are 12 years. Here's 12 years of your track record to show that you not only do you not care about public safety, but as the state's chief law enforcer, public safety got significantly worse under your watch. And then he says, so there was also the first campaign ad. I just want to replay it because it folds into this tweet he sent out yesterday. So remember his first campaign ad where he was saying, I'm going to stand up to the status quo. Here's a clip.
It won't be easy, but I've never been satisfied with the status quo.
And as we pointed out, you are the status quo. By any definition, you're the status quo. You've been in politics for years and years. You've been the attorney general for 12 years, and you are very closely aligned politically. There's hardly any daylight between you and Jay Inslee, the guy you're trying to replace, who's been the governor for 12 years. You're endorsed by Jay Inslee. You're endorsed by his predecessor, Christine Gregoire. So explain to me how you are not the status quo candidate. And then he sent out this humdinger yesterday. Remember we ranted about the ferry system yesterday? Well, Bob Ferguson's on it. He says, I took a ferry to Bainbridge Island for some great conversations with Washingtonians about healthcare, reproductive freedom, and the ferry system. I'm committed to changing the culture of state government to deliver on the needs of Washingtonians. You helped create the current culture of state government. Literally. And if you didn't, then where have you been? Are you going to sit there and tell me that you, as the attorney general for 12 years, have had no role in creating the existing culture of state government in Washington? If that's the argument you're going to make, then you're basically saying you were a worthless attorney general who was completely disconnected from what was happening in Olympia. But of course, you can't make that argument. You have contributed to the culture of state government the way that it is. You have supported Jay Inslee at every turn as well in his role. You haven't condemned anything that he's done. And also, in saying this, aren't you saying that you think Jay Inslee did a bad job of being governor, right? If you're suggesting that the current culture of state government isn't great and we need you to come in and fix it, aren't you saying Jay Inslee did a bad job? Oh, scandalous, going against Jay Inslee. But no, he wants people to believe that he's like this, like, new, fresh, exciting leader. And it's like, no, you've been around forever. You've been leading in our state forever. And I use the phrase leading very, very loosely. You have been put in positions of power. And now you're saying, just give me a little more power. And this time I'll do better. And this time, like, I'll change the culture of state government. These people. And I just kills me knowing how many people see that and they're like, oh, he's great. He's just what the doctor ordered. And I'm like, dude, even if he is going to come in and change a bunch of things, aren't you curious why he didn't do anything for the last 12 years? That doesn't make any sense to me. He is the status quo. So, and that's fine. If you want the state to continue down the path that it's on right now, 100% vote for Bob Ferguson. If you are very happy with the path that the state of Washington is on, 100%, I highly suggest that you vote for Bob Ferguson, because he will keep things going. He'll keep us on this path. If that pleases you, fill in a little circle next to Bob Ferguson. I wish you well. But that's what you're going to get. So speaking of threats to our democracy and our, people always say, Brandy, we're a democratic republic. I get it. But democracy in the larger sense of us going out and exercising our right to choose who represents us. So there was last week, you'll recall, and there's this renewed conversation about undocumented immigrants and whether they're going to try to vote, whether, I think there's a conspiracy side of it. But what have we said about conspiracies? Nothing's a conspiracy anymore, because yesterday's conspiracy is today's front page news. So I'm not going to write this one off, but there's this thought by some on the right that you have these open borders, millions of undocumented illegal immigrants coming into the country, and that Democrats basically want to add to their voter base. And they're going to find a way to either like mass amnesty and now make all these people that they've allowed to come in the country citizens to vote, or else going to make it very difficult to stop them from voting in terms of the processes that we would go through to ensure that only lawful permanent residents of the United States can cast a ballot. So last week, this is from the Associated Press, House passes GOP bill requiring proof of citizenship to vote, boosting election year talking point. Of course, the AP, just the headline. It's more than a talking point. It's a genuine conversation to have about whether being flooded with illegal immigrants, we need to do more to ensure that they don't get their hands on a ballot and turn it in. So I'll just read part of this because it's going to be very relevant to a local angle on this I want to discuss next. The House on last Wednesday, passed a proof of citizenship requirement for voter registration, a proposal Republicans have prioritized as an election year talking point, even as research shows non-citizens illegally registering and casting ballots in federal elections is exceptionally rare. The legislation approved largely along partisan lines, but with five Democrats voting in favor, is unlikely to advance through the Democrat-led Senate. The Biden administration also says it is strongly opposed because there are already safeguards to enforce the law against non-citizens voting. Let me just touch on that quick. I don't understand how you can be strongly opposed to something that, in your belief, would just strengthen existing laws. So we have the existing law, right, that you're saying, and it does, it was passed in the mid-1990s, that says you cannot vote as an illegal citizen of the United States, as an illegal immigrant to the United States. So what the Biden administration is saying is that this does something that law already provides for. So why would you be strongly opposed to it? It's just redundant? Is that what your argument is? Well, this is just redundant. So I'm strongly opposed to it. That doesn't make any sense. I'll continue to read the AP story. Still, the House vote will give Republicans an opportunity to bring attention to two of their central issues this year, border and election security. It also provides an opportunity to fuel former President Donald Trump's claims that Democrats have encouraged the surge of migrants so they can register them to vote, which would be illegal. Non-citizens are not allowed to vote in federal elections, nor is it allowed for in any statewide election. Research and audits in several states show there have been incidences of non-citizens who successfully registered to vote and cast ballots, but it happens rarely and is typically by mistake. States have mechanisms to check for it, although there isn't one standard protocol they all follow. So again, think about that. First of all, our government passes laws all the time that apply to and kick in only in very rare instances. And I'll give you an example of a local one coming up. But again, you're saying, and the Associated Press is saying, like, people rarely do it. And when they do, it's by accident. So we don't need this in place. Okay, but you can't vote. It's illegal to vote in the United States in a federal election or in any state elections if you're an illegal immigrant, if you're in the country illegally. So why would we be opposed, if it's already illegal, why would we be opposed to putting the simplest safeguard in place, which is you have to show proof of citizenship when you register to vote? if that's already the law in principle, why would you not ensure that that law in practice is strong? And why would you not do it in, again, the easiest way possible? That makes no sense. So we got an email from a woman named Kathleen. She had sent it, she's a Seattle resident. She sent an email to King County Elections talking about this very issue. And I've got to say, although we knew this was the case, that like Washington state law doesn't require that you actually show you're a lawful permanent resident. So even though we knew that was the case, it just hits different seeing it in black and white and seeing how King County Elections describes the process to this Seattle resident, Kathleen. So I want to go through the emails for you. She says, to whom it may concern, I'm looking at your website. If someone wants to register in person and they don't have proof of U.S. citizenship, such as a birth certificate or proof of naturalization, what do you say to them? You can't register them to vote, correct? Thank you, Kathleen. So she got a response from the King County Elections Office. It says, hello, and has a link to the RCW on this very issue. The minimum required information provided on a voter registration application in order to place a voter registration applicant on the voter registration rolls includes their name, their residential address, their date of birth, a signature attesting to the truth of the information provided on the application, an address where the person receives mail, and affirmation of citizenship, which confirms the individual is a United States citizen in one of the following forms. So here's all that's asked of someone. A check or indication in the box on a voter registration form confirming citizenship, or you can present a document as part of another government transaction confirming citizenship. Let us know if you have any other questions. So their answer is basically to send her RCW and say, all that they would require is you give your name, where you live, your date of birth, which none of that proves you're a citizen, right? But to prove you're a citizen, all you have to do is check the box to attest to. It's the honor system. I'm a citizen of the United States. And that's all the further investigation they'll do in King County Elections to confirm that you are legally allowed to vote and that you're not an illegal immigrant. So Kathleen responds, I love Kathleen. She's great. She's like doing her own reporting here. So do you mean that if someone marks a box that they're a U.S. citizen, you don't ask for valid proof? What if they're untruthful? To which Penny, a supervisor in voter services at King County Elections, responds, hi, Kathleen. Washington state law does not require proof of citizenship to register to vote. When a person checks this box and signs an oath, they are attesting under penalty of perjury that all information provided on the form is factual. Here in King County, we have not found that this is an issue. Most non-citizens are aware that they are unable to vote until they are granted citizenship and are aware that doing so will create a barrier to citizenship. On the rare occasion when a non-citizen mistakenly registers, they contact our office to cancel as soon as they become aware of the error. Please let me know if you have any further questions. Kathleen responds, Penny, this is most disturbing news. People lie. We often have very close elections. You use the honor code and don't know who is being dishonest. This is scary information. To which Penny responds, as I mentioned, the occurrence is rare. There have been many studies done that have shown that the incidence of this happening across the U.S. is extremely low. At any rate, we follow state law. If folks are interested in getting the laws changed, they need to contact their legislators. Now, think about this for a second. King County Elections is saying, you know, based on state law, so I imagine you'd hear the same argument from a lot of other elections offices across the state, that this is very rare, that you have these people who know, well, I can't register to vote and vote because I'm in the country illegally. And so the suggestion here is that they would never do that. And when they do, it's by mistake and they find out and they call the office and say, hey, I mistakenly registered to vote. I'm in the country illegally and I can't vote. Can you take me off the voter rolls? You want me to believe that someone whose first act in the United States was to break the law by coming here illegally then cares if they illegally register to vote? Why would they care? Now, I understand that there are some people who are not lawful permanent residents, but who have legal authorization to be in the United States and are working toward their citizenship. That's a completely different group of people. I agree. Those people are probably very, very unlikely to do anything that would put their path to citizenship in jeopardy, including unlawfully voting or registering to vote and claiming that they're a U.S. citizen when they're not. Totally different group of people. put them aside. We're talking about the millions of people who have come into this country illegally, knowing that they were violating the law. And we're supposed to take them on the honor system. But when they check a box to say, oh, I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm going to vote, when they already came here illegally. And all of this to me is such a moot point because, again, so you go back and how the federal law says, okay, the federal law was passed. I have the name of it here somewhere if you want to go look it up. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. So it prohibits non-citizens from voting in federal elections. It doesn't dictate what happens in state elections, but there's no state in the U.S. that allows non-citizens to vote in elections, right? So you already have states that recognize, like, non-citizens can't vote. So what's the process? And we've reached out to the Secretary of State's office this morning. We're waiting for a response because our question is, how do you determine if an illegal immigrant voted? What is the system? Because that's not consistent across the country. Every state has their own system. But when is that happening? Is it happening proactively? I doubt it. So you're probably talking about instances after the fact where maybe there's some sort of audit or look at voter rolls or some outside entity, some third party says, hey, we went through it and we found that this person isn't even a citizen. And then it comes to the state's attention. Because I'm very curious, is there any proactive way that the state is looking at voting registries and saying, hey, this person voted and they shouldn't have voted? For across the state, there are a variety of methods that states use. Federal databases, such as Social Security Administration or State Department of Motor Vehicle databases, for instance, they say they can cross-reference that information. You know what's a lot easier? Just having them provide proof of citizenship up front. Is that not much easier than the chance, even if it happens rarely, that they register to vote unlawfully, that they vote unlawfully, and you find out about it a year later after votes have already been counted? What good reason is there? What good reason, common sense reason is there not to head all of that off and restore trust in the election process, in the process of doing that? Just to say, hey, you're registering to vote. Here's how you prove that you're a lawful permanent resident of the United States and legally able to vote. Do you have a document? No? Well, then you can't. What am I missing about why would that be controversial? I don't understand. I fail to understand why that would be controversial. People have to show documents to come into the United States and just travel here for leisure, right? You have to, if you want to visit here, you have to show your passport to be able to get in, and then you've got all these documents and they know where you are and they know what you're doing. But you're saying that we can't just have one simple check to say, you're not a legal resident, so sorry, you can't register. And Kathleen, I mean, I'm glad that she was pushing King County saying, you're just doing this on the honor system. So we've reached out to the Secretary of State's office. We asked a couple things. Are the statements that the King County Elections Office made to Kathleen consistent with state law and your expectation of how this is supposed to work? What do you say to citizens who see this as an opportunity for fraud? Because you don't have to cast a ballot for it to be like you're looking at every single time that happens. It's an opportunity for fraud. Now, whether they carry through and they actually vote, that's a totally different thing. But we want to reduce opportunities for fraud so we can increase trust in our election process. And then we asked, how would the state find out that a non-citizen has voted? I think that's the critical, critical question. And then again, if non-citizens can't vote, why would you not just require proof up front? That's the easiest way to do it. It's the most streamlined, probably the cheapest way to do it. And it's the way to do it that would instill the most trust in our election process. So you're saying, hey, not a big deal. This rarely happens. Okay. It's not a big deal. Let's just do it. I fail to see if anyone has a legitimate reason, legitimate, non-hyperpartisan, like fact-based reason why we couldn't just ask for proof of citizenship for everyone, whether it's me going in, whether it's Nicole going in, whether it's someone of Mexican descent going in. Like, this isn't about, oh, you're in the elections office, and if they look like they might be from a different country, you know, if their skin is too dark, like, ask them if they're a citizen. No, ask everybody. Everybody who registers to vote, they have to provide proof that they're a U.S. citizen. And then it's fair, it's not discriminatory, period. God, this stuff is weird. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, because there's always a lot of conversations as we near election time about what we can do to restore trust in the process, and also just to make sure that the process is more transparent and that it is reducing opportunities for fraud. So I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, what election change at the state level would you most be in favor of? Most be in favor of? A return to in-person voting, requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote, or biannual audits of voter rolls. So this would happen twice a year. They would go through, get rid of any people who are deceased, who are no longer qualified to vote, who might have unlawfully registered to vote. A lot of you are saying that the number one thing, this actually surprised me, is require proof of citizenship to register, because we hear a lot of talk about returning to in-person voting, but turns out a lot of people like the mail-in voting. I love it. I love it. And I actually would be opposed to a return to in-person voting. I like it as an option. Like, hey, if you want to vote in person, you can do that. But I don't want to go back to doing that. Sorry. I think that if we can make sure our voter rolls are up to date, that we're requiring proper proof to register to vote, then mail-in ballots and the concerns around those wouldn't be such a big issue. Let's see some comments. I pulled comments on that from Patreon yesterday. So let's do locals and X, shall we? Reagan on X says, with the number of illegals entering our country, I think this will be a huge issue in the coming years. They are given voter registration packets when they're given benefits, and no one is stopping them from registering to vote. And we now know that if they choose to be dishonest and break the law, they can very easily register to vote. It is as simple as just checking a box to say, yep, I'm a lawful permanent resident. Let's see, Weiss Castle on locals, almost like asking, which child do I love more? Hard to understand why proof of meeting the requirements is not required. It's so basic. I just don't understand why you wouldn't do it. Where else do we not do that? But then he says, but ballot harvesting is also a big threat to bad election results. Not sure you have the desired outcome. Just go shake a few more ballots out of the tree where you know your candidate is favored. It's got to stop. Yeah, ballot harvesting. But Republicans need to ballot harvest. And I think that they've started to lean into that and understand that if Democrats are ballot harvesting, that you've just got to do it too. You got to play by the rules that you're given. If you want to change the rules, try to do that. But if the other side's doing it, man, you got to be doing it as well. R.C. Larson says, call me old fashioned, but I think we need to go back to in-person voting and make it a holiday or two-day election day so we have fewer excuses for not being able to vote. There was a certain amount of pride you felt when you stepped into the voting booth. That's missing today. And why should voting be easier, convenient? I also believe proof of citizenship should be required. I agree and disagree. I did like, and I started, so my first election was in Nebraska, and so you did go to vote, and I did like doing that, but I do think voting should be as easy and convenient as possible. There are people who work, there are people who have two jobs, there are people who have kids and tough schedules, and I think, you know, reducing it to one day where you've got to make time to go somewhere when, as you pointed out, it's not a national holiday, I don't like that. I don't want to go back to that. I want as many people to participate in the process legally as possible. One more comment. Chris on Local says, I don't have a problem with vote by mail, but that has to accompany clean voter rolls. We must also have proof of citizenship to register. And that's kind of similar to what I was saying is, if you've got all the other things, like voter rolls have been cleaned up on a regular basis, you already had to provide proof of citizenship to register to vote in the first place, then I don't think the mail-in voting thing is such a big deal. I know you got the chain of custody issues where you throw a ballot in USPS and you just pray to God that USPS gets it to where it's going on time. So interesting conversation. I'm sure we'll talk about a lot of this as we approach the primary election, which, you guys, it's 1, 2, 2.5 weeks away. Aren't you excited? I'm excited. Ballots should be coming out soon. All right. If you're in the market to sell your home, I have encouraged you to reach out to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. You know, the Fed hasn't dropped interest rates. There's a lot of uncertainty, I think, for home buyers and for home sellers. But Wes said this is really an opportunity where housing prices are pretty high. The average home price is pretty high across Washington State. And you're going to start to see inventory creep up. So for home sellers, if you can sell now, this might be the best time.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come up, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, what are you waiting for? So visit sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. You can start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. Oh, man. I you know, Nicole, I need you to start creating folders, like predictions from Brandy. And then, like, because they're all going to come true, right? And so,
of course,
all of them. And then I have it in a neat little place where I can just go back, pull the receipt out, bring it forth, and just tell everyone what a genius I am. A humble, humble genius. Because, you know, one of the things I've been saying for years is it's important for the whole country, I think, to pay attention to what happens on the West Coast and some of the policies that are being pushed right now or for the last 5-10 years on the West Coast, because it's only a matter of time before that brand of progressivism finds its way across the entire country into Congress. And we've seen that more and more because progressives and Democrats on the West Coast are I think, a rare breed. You know, I use my mother as an example often. My mom thinks she's a Democrat in Minnesota. Mom, I love you. If I plopped you in Seattle, you would not be a Democrat. You would reject the party as quickly as you possibly could. But we're seeing this brand of progressivism and things that are attempted, you know, be it the minimum wage, for instance, and it starts here and then all of a sudden you have it popping up in Congress. And so it's really important, no matter where you live, to pay attention to what's happening in California, in Oregon, in Seattle, because the policies here are the policies today here are the policies of tomorrow on the West Coast. So that brings me to the latest proposal from President Joe Biden, and that is to institute rent control across the entire country, which is just such an odd thing for him to propose at a time when he is flailing in the polls. This from Bloomberg. Biden calls for national rent control on corporate landlords. The White House proposal would cap rent increases at 5% for millions of tenants nationwide. Now, of course, would this get past the Republican-controlled House? Probably not. But I think it's very relevant that Joe Biden is pushing this. So basically, the proposal would give landlords a choice. Either you agree to cap rent prices, rent hikes at no more than 5% a year, or you would forfeit federal tax breaks coveted by rental property owners. It's like, wow, what a choice is that? Not much of a choice at all. And so obviously, you're looking at this proposed at a national level. So we'd be part of that, despite the fact that we already have some pretty strict controls for landlords here. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at the Rental Housing Association of Washington. We've been partnering with them for a weekly segment to talk about really how backward some of these laws and proposals are when it comes to some of the crises we're dealing with, like the affordability crisis. You have Democrats talk over and over about affordable housing, yet they're pushing policies that make housing less affordable and make housing choices and options less available. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. So to talk about President Biden's proposal, we wanted to have in Representative Andrew Barkus. He is a Republican representing the Olympia area. He's also a longtime landlord. And so we had him react to what Joe Biden is pushing. Nationwide rent control. You're in favor of it, right? Great idea.
Just what we need. Let's price fix at a national level, a housing market that's already all screwed up, and make it even better with a good federal government policy. Crazy that he's even proposing this. There are so many other things I can tell you that we've been working on, but you know, I'm not surprised. We've seen this at the state level for years. Last year was the big fight. I was proud that we were able to stop that legislation once again. It's not done. They're coming back again in 2025, but it's all at the local level. It's everywhere, and now the federal level. So, you know, bad policy, bad idea. Rent has been going up all around our country, but it's not because landlords are forcing this up. It's because of the economic pressures that we're feeling. You know, it's no secret. I've been in the business for 30 years, and I can tell you we've lost so much supply out of our portfolio because of the regulatory, the eviction, all the other things that you just mentioned. But when you start looking at the totality of property taxes and regulatory environment and all the other things that we're seeing at all levels of our government, it makes it more and more difficult. Rents have to keep pace with the cost to do business to provide the housing, and they're not. We're working right now, and you mentioned RHA does this segment, been working with them literally since a day or two after session, we started meeting to work on policy to counteract this. And the most important thing we need to do in Washington State is not have this discussion about rent capping, but about fixing the eviction system, fixing a broken system that's affecting everybody, especially what we're hearing with the nonprofits who are going broke because they're millions and millions of dollars in the hole. We need to look at fixing the eviction system, and then we need to look at some short-term, what I call bridging the gap type of vouchers for those most in need that are feeling that pinch between increasing rents and everything else while we continue to work on supply, which is the biggest thing that we've been trying to do in the legislature.
Yeah, and we had RHA on to talk about kind of what they're trying to put together, a one-time, like you said, a bridge. And this is not controversial. I mean, it's better for our system as a whole and for taxpayers as a whole if someone doesn't, you know, for maybe extend into a year, 2 year squatting ordeal with a landlord or fall into homelessness. If they lost a job, if they had an unforeseen medical expense or something, I don't like throwing taxpayer money at people, but that is a much better use of it than the amount of taxpayer money that's going to come if they fall into homelessness or something like that. Do you believe, since this is about helping, right, tenants bridge that gap, do you think you'd have some bipartisan support to do something like that this session?
You know, I truly believe that we would have bipartisan support. I've been putting forth this solution for several years. You know, 2023 was the year of housing, very bipartisan. I led that, worked on middle housing, ADUs, all sorts of stuff. 2024 was supposed to be, you know, version two of that, and it wasn't because of the rent control debate. Sucked all the air out of the room, right? It's all we could focus on. They wouldn't even take into consideration the voucher programs. They wouldn't even take into consideration several bipartisan bills to say, look, we have this money over here. Let's put it to use in a manner that can help most people today that are truly in need. And there's safeguards built in it now. Oh, we're just... you're going to give the money to landlords, they're just going to raise the rent anyway. No, there are safeguards that we build in the legislation. So we're going to put that forth again, Brandy. We're going to talk about dedicated funding sources. This state has already thrown out close to $1 billion over since COVID, peppered all over the place. What happened with some of that money? But, you know, to get at this problem, knowing full well that there would be what we call a bow wave. Once that Fed money goes away, guess what? We have a problem because these people are now reliant on this money coming in. I'm not talking about long-term. I'm talking about somebody who has a situation where they've seen their rent go up a couple hundred bucks, could be classified for the most vulnerable seniors, you know, a classification, get them immediate help for a short period of time. The market is adjusting. Rents are coming down with some supply coming back on, interest rates, sales, all the different things. You can't mess with it by putting rent control in play. And I don't care if they say, oh, it won't affect X amount of units and it won't do this and won't do that. It will affect the entirety of the industry. You cannot separate it out, you know, by saying, oh, anything that new construction is exempted. Really? For how long? You know, 10 years now, and then it goes to 2 years, and it goes, doesn't work. So I'm confident on the work we're doing. I'm excited about the policies coming forth. Actually, I have a meeting with the Lieutenant Governor, Denny Heck. He's been pretty good at bringing these coalitions together. He was very frustrated last year to see this happen. And we're having a bipartisan meeting here on August 1st to talk about this, and then we'll continue to work on these policies.
Oh, great. We'd love to follow up with you after that meeting to see how productive it is. I will say, if something comes to fruition, there's a bill that's crafted that would provide some temporary assistance for tenants, I would support it vocally, with one exception. If it would have, for me, the help that's limitless would have to go away. The things like the King County Justice Project, where they're housing justice, where they're giving $50,000 to one tenant. I'm not going to be a both. It's either or for me. So if you guys can't force Democrats to get rid of this stuff, then I'm not going to support just putting more money toward it.
I couldn't agree with you more. And at the core, as I said before, eviction reform. The Housing Justice Project, I call them the Housing Justice League, it's failed. I mean, when you see the amount of money going in, the situations, and there are case examples all over the place of this. When we fought and when they brought in free legal, right, they said, oh, this is going to be the big thing that's going to help everybody. Really? With no strings attached. It's caused more problems in the system. When they flooded all these things and then they told everybody, hey, you don't have to pay rent. Guess what? People stop paying their rent. Yeah. There are some buildings, these are low income, that are in 30 to 40% rent collection. Millions of dollars in the hole. And you just saw this. I think you even reported on this. They just, out of the housing fund in the city of Seattle, doled out about $14 million to to make right these nonprofits that are sinking because of their own policies.
Yep.
So eviction reform must be the centerpiece, overarching. And yes, it cannot be tied together. You must have, you know, if you're truly going for this voucher, you can't be one of those persons sitting there with 6 months of non-paid rent and have gone through this whole thing and worked the system and everything. No, we have to reform the system. We have to reform eviction reform while also putting this other stuff in play. It's a heavy lift.
Yeah.
It's a heavy lift because they don't think it's broken, but I do believe it's changing because of these nonprofits are now kind of looking, going, wait a minute, this is affecting us too, not just the big corporate greedy guys. Everybody is affected by this bad policy.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that something can change in the upcoming legislative session and that, you know, Joe Biden just sets this one on the back burner, Joe. Put it on the back
with a lot
in
of
the
other
trash,
things but... that you should say. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Representative Barkas, we appreciate your time.
Brandy, anytime, and thanks for everything that you're doing. I just really appreciate you and the opportunity to talk to you about this and many other things. So have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Now, look, don't get me wrong. Rents are too damn high. Rent is absolutely too high. But, you know, the idea that rent control, that burdensome regulations from the government, that, you know, the environmental requirements for new home construction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the idea that that's going to solve the problem is absolutely ludicrous. And so I think that's where I take issue with it. The idea that more government regulation, more costs, more burdens placed on landlords is somehow going to lead to them dropping rents is absolutely asinine. And as Andrew Barkas and I have discussed before, if you put, let's just say, 7% cap on rent increases, what is the landlord going to do every year? They're going to raise rent every single year by 7% because they're trying to kind of plan for unknowns. And if you put them in a tough position where, man, I raised rent X amount and I can't raise rent again for another, you know, how many months, then what you're going to do is you're just going to hedge your bets and say every single year, you're going to tell your tenants every single year, max, 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 max rent increases. And you're going to end up increasing rent more than you would have otherwise. So it's just the dumbest idea. And then you combine that, of course, with the regulations on new home construction. You know, God forbid the initiative to protect natural gas in homes isn't successful in November. Then you can add that. You can add $30,000 to the cost of, you know, electrifying a home, which landlords are going to pass along to people who are renting their homes. This isn't rocket science, people. One other thing I just want to point out for you to be thinking about. We are losing in the Washington State Senate. So they already tried rent control this past session, and it only failed by a tiny, tiny little bit in the Senate. You are losing Senators Mullett and Van de Wege, the two most moderate Democrats who were responsible for stopping that thing from becoming law this year. So Mullett's running for governor, and Van de Wege is running for commissioner of public lands, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Commissioner of Public Lands. It's like I should be a political reporter or something and know what I'm talking about. I think he's running for Commissioner of Public Lands. And so they're gone. So depending on who replaces them, it's very possible if it's brought back up this year, if there aren't significant changes in November on the election front, on the makeup of the House and the Senate, maybe in the governor's office, fingers crossed, it is very possible that they're able to push rent control through no problem at all. So we have to start thinking about that now and pushing back about that now. You're nodding yes. He's running for Commissioner of Public Lands. So just something to consider. And if you are a landlord currently in the state of Washington, do not navigate this mess on your own. Become a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. You can sign up. It's $260 for an entire year. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. And you can fight this disaster with them in your corner. All right, I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. Why? Because it just makes good sense. It's free and you could save money on your insurance. I'm a member of the First Mark family. Nicole's a member of the First Mark family. Undivided as a business is insured through First Mark Insurance. And we hear so many wonderful stories from, gosh, we get these all the time from you guys. Maggie said that she had to resign from her job after an unexpected situation. She'd heard me talking about First Mark and doing the First Mark Challenge forever. She decided, okay, this is my cue to do it. She also got her latest car insurance bill. It went up yet again. So she's like, I need to see if I can save money. She ended up connecting with Levi at First Mark. He reviewed her car and home insurance, recommended a new bundle that was half the cost and better coverage. Imagine that today. Take the First Mark Challenge today. They go out, they do their thing, they shop their carriers, and they come back and tell you that they can cut your insurance costs in half. So that's what happened to Maggie. She said she was so surprised and thankful. So take the First Mark Challenge today, firstmarkinsurance.com. Not only does the First Mark Challenge cost you nothing, you never pay First Mark Insurance for their services. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, and it truly is a no-brainer. All right, add California to the list of states that believe they can parent better than parents can. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Boop. So for a long time on a lot of issues, I think California does it first and then Washington follows suit. But unfortunately, this is one of the issues that Washington has led the way on, although it is not leadership in any form, and that is eroding parental rights. Washington state eroded parental rights so much so that more than 400,000 Washingtonians pushed through an initiative to the legislature that was passed into law that restored parental rights. Now, we know that that initiative and the law that was created by it hasn't been followed to the T, and there are efforts underway legally to try to undo it. But putting that aside, you know, we have had quite a fight on our hands here in Washington for the last 3 years to try to put parenting back where it belongs, in the household, to let parents be parents, to make sure the government isn't hiding information from parents about their kids. You know, there are a few issues here, 5599, which said, oh, if you're parent doesn't support your gender identity, you can run away to a shelter and we won't even tell your parents where you are. And we'll help facilitate the health care that you need. And then, of course, there's this statewide policy from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction that says that your child's gender identity is protected health care information. That's how OSPI looks at it. So if your kid goes to school, they're Billy at home, and they decide that they want to be Bethany at school, identify as a girl, the teachers call them that, fellow students call them that, it's totally fine for the school. And the school must, unless the child wants you to know, keep that information hidden from you. Like, they could even be seeing a counselor at school to talk about the mental challenges they're dealing with their gender confusion. And at home, you're sitting at home blissfully unaware of this very serious thing your child is going through at school. It's insane. Well, now that's happening down in California. This from the Los Angeles Times. Governor Gavin Newsom signs bill banning schools from notifying parents about a student's gender identity. So this takes it, honestly, even further than Washington. You have an OSPI policy that dictates this in Washington state. And the head of OSPI here says that he's not even going to change that, despite the initiative that voters pushed through here. He was like, big middle finger to the voters in the initiative. But Gavin Newsom just signed a bill into law that mandates that schools not inform parents about a student's gender identity. It says Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill on Monday that prohibits mandating that teachers notify families about student gender identity changes, capping a year-long battle between conservative school boards concerned about parental rights and LGBTQ activists worried about vulnerable youth. The new law shields teachers from retaliation for supporting transgender student rights and prohibits K-12, quote, forced disclosure rules. It comes in response to school board decisions in some red pockets of California to notify parents if their child changes their name or pronouns, or if students request to use faculties or participate in programs that don't match their gender on official records. So here you had California where you had to notify parents, which makes sense, right? Like, oh, your student wants to change their name in school records? Your student is a boy and wants to participate in girls' sports? Like, yeah, that makes sense that you would talk to the parents about that. But now in California, teachers are protected, schools are protected, and they can protect that information within the walls of a school if a child, even a third or fourth grader, wants to say, well, I'm going to come to school, and because of peer pressure or whatever it is, I'm going to say that I'm a boy and I'm really a girl. It's insane stuff. And, you know, a couple things on that, the way that LA Times article is written that just really bothers me, where it says, the new law shields teachers from retaliation for supporting transgender student rights. You can support transgender students as a teacher. You can support what a child is going through, you know, whether it's their sexual orientation or gender confusion. You can be supportive without cutting parents out. And just the idea that you think it's supportive to cut parents out shows that you think you can parent better than a parent can. shows that you inherently, you're thinking the worst. What this law does is it assigns the worst intentions to every single parent. A parent can't possibly be trusted with that information. A parent can't possibly navigate such a complex emotional situation with their kid. We have to do it for them. As the teacher, we're going to step in and be the parent and provide love and support of this transgender youth, because no way in hell the parent's going to be able to. That's offensive. And it's offensive to parents who would be totally supportive of kids for who decide to change their gender identity. To say, like, just automatically by default, the parent is completely incapable of navigating a complex mental and emotional situation with their kids. How offensive is that? What was the other thing that I was going to point out? Just coming together, says, yeah, a year-long battle between conservative school boards concerned about parental rights and LGBTQ activists worried about vulnerable youth. It just goes into this same thing. Like, you're just assuming the child is vulnerable if their parents know everything that's going on in their life. Like, there are laws for parental abuse. If a parent's abusing a child, that's a totally different situation. If a parent just has an issue with their child saying, I'm a girl now, like, that's none of your business as a school. It's none of your business, the forced acceptance or forcing parents to deal with the situation in a certain way. It's wild. Elon Musk agrees. And Elon Musk came out, said this is the final straw. He's moving his businesses, not only SpaceX, but he's moving X as well, out of the state of California. This from the New York Times. Elon Musk says he will move X and SpaceX headquarters to Texas. Elon Musk said on Tuesday he would move the headquarters of two of his businesses, the social media platform X, the rocket manufacturer SpaceX, from California to Texas in protest against a new law designed to protect transgender children. He said, quote, this is the final straw. He said it is attacking both families and companies. He said he had previously warned California Governor Gavin Newsom that that would be the consequence if this law was passed and signed. SpaceX will move its headquarters from Hawthorne, California, to its Starbase facility in Boca Chica, Texas. X, which is based in San Francisco, will move to Austin. And that is, I mean, I'm sure Gavin Newsom will say, I haven't seen if he's responded to this, I'm sure he'll say, good riddance. But he knows that that's detrimental.
Now I know why he has so many babies. When he says stuff like that, I'm like, oh, I love that guy.
Oh, that's what I was expecting. Nicole wants to do it with Elon Musk because he says stuff like that. That's essentially what you just said. No wonder he has so many babies. Oh, I love it. But, I mean, you know, he also, different area codes. He's got,
yeah.
I'm not calling him hoes, but it's the song, hoes in different area codes. You know, it's like, well, now you can leave behind the baby mamas in California and just, you know, start with some new ones in there Texas. So I don't disagree with this. This is what needs to happen. I mean, you know, there needs to be financial flight. There needs to be financial consequences for states. You can think about how much tax revenue they're going to lose by losing SpaceX, by losing X, the jobs, etc. It all has consequences. And this is a pretty extreme thing. Nicole was saying Gavin Newsom must, we were doing our pre-show prep, he must not at all be interested in running for president this cycle at all anymore, because we'd kind of thought he was low-key gunning for it, hoping that Joe Biden drops out. But now, if you sign something this controversial, this is not at all a mainstream bill. This thing would not be accepted in a lot of quote-unquote blue states in the Midwest and the East Coast, because I said earlier, it's a special brand of progressivism on the West Coast, and those sorts of policies would not fly in any sort of national race. So I also just think Dems have really given up. And that's why, you know, I just accepted the steak dinner thing, because they know after the assassination attempt that and Trump's polls are better than they've ever been before. They know that there's probably no way to beat him. So they're not going to waste some fresh face like Gavin Newsom, if you can call him a fresh face, on what will be a failed endeavor unless there's some significant change. So Gavin Newsom's going to hold tight. He'll run in 2028.
I mean, I don't even know why he's doing this in his state. There's really no reason for it, because you've already established that's the case. So it just seems like a extreme.
Oh, it's totally extremist
for no good reason.
Totally extremist. Yeah, wild stuff. Okay, I've talked about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program before. We review some highlights from the RNC. Good stuff, good speakers at the RNC. I have lost 40 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. You guys will remember I was in TV and then I left, and during the pandemic I gained like 40 pounds. I lost most of that in just 2 months on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. It really reshapes your way of thinking around food. It teaches you what to eat in the right portions and then how to maintain the weight loss for life. I've maintained it for a year and a half. And it really just takes some simple lifestyle changes. And, you know, you have your off weeks with any plan and program. I mean, Nicole and I have been all over the place doing weddings and I ate and drank a lot this weekend, but then I come back and I'm like, that's all right. I always got the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic maintenance program, and it's easy to sort of jump back on it and make sure that you stay where you want to be. So EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule your free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team today, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, Republicans are doing something very, very effective at the Republican National Convention, and they're highlighting the voices of everyday Americans who have been through things that really reinforce in the minds of Republicans why Donald Trump would be the better president. So you're talking about, you know, things around the border and crime and energy independence and taxation, all of this stuff. And they look for everyday Americans with really compelling stories. And they've been giving them some prime time speaking slots to be heard across all the networks. It's effective for a couple reasons. One, as you're going to hear, the stories are emotional, they're profound, they're stories that every single person in the country needs to hear, Democrat and Republican. But also, it's hard for the other side to turn around and find fault there, right? It's hard for when CNN comes out after the speech to say, well, that really sucked and that was fear-mongering. It's like, no, that was a mom who lost their child. It's like hard to be as vitriolic and as partisan when you're talking about an everyday American who's there to tell a true story of something that happened to them. So in that sense, I think it's really effective. So I want to play a couple. There were a few, two speeches in particular from moms that were just heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. So Madeline Brame, we'll start with her. She is the mom of U.S. Army veteran Sergeant Hassan Correa. He was stabbed to death. It was like a group attack, stabbed to death on the streets of New York City. And as we see so many times in New York City, unless it's Alvin Bragg prosecuting Donald Trump to the fullest extent of the law, there are some violent crimes where people are just being given sweetheart plea deals or sweetheart deals, spend virtually no time in prison. And that was the case for a couple of the people involved in the attack on her son. Here's a clip of what she had to say at the RNC.
We need justice for victims. And we need accountability for prosecutors who fail in their duty. Soft on crime prosecutors like Alvin Bragg in New York, Kim Fox in Chicago, and George Gascon in Los Angeles have turned our great country and cities into war zones. The Democratic Party that poor minorities have been loyal to for decades, including myself, all right? They betrayed us. They stabbed us in the back. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who claim to represent us, have abandoned us. They neglected the poor minority communities across America. But my eyes have been opened. Just like so many other poor minorities across America. Donald Trump shares our values, love of God and family and country. He's been a victim of the same corrupt system that I have been and my family has been. He is committed to providing economic opportunities, helping those suffering from addiction with long-term inpatient drug programs, rolling back deadly bail reform policies that are getting our children killed every single day, and supporting our police. We back the NYPD. We back the blue.
Holy smokes. I have goosebumps on both my arms and both my legs. I mean, talk about effective communicator. That's for a quote unquote, what they call everyday American. That's a hell of a passionate everyday American. And again, how do you discount that? How do you discount that woman of color, mom whose son was a veteran, served in Afghanistan, served in a war zone? You can't discount it. She lost her son, and here's all the things she's saying and why it has brought her, a lifelong Democrat, to support Donald Trump. That is about as effective as you can get. I said the other day, on the first day, Amber Rose, who I was like, why are they having Amber Rose speak when there's nude pics of her all over online? Doesn't seem very conservative to me. She was the best speaker of the night because she's communicating, and the same would go for Madeleine Braham. They're communicating to a segment of the country that a traditional Republican just cannot get through to and does not do a good job, an effective job communicating with. And so it's incredibly ingenious to have these people up there telling those stories. It's one thing for Donald Trump or a Republican politician to rant and rave about soft on crime policies and these soft on crime prosecutors, but a mom of color who's been a lifelong Democrat who lost her son talking about it, man, that is effective. There was another mom, Ann Fundner. This was devastating. I highly recommend you go watch both of these women, their full remarks. But I just want to play a part of this. Ann lost her son, Weston, to a fentanyl overdose.
We had family dinners and barbecues at the beach. And like most teenagers, Weston wanted to fit in. And in a moment of peer pressure, he tried something that someone gave to him, and it took my baby's life. We did everything right. I had those conversations with him, and fentanyl still found my son. And on February 27th, 2022, our lives were shattered, and our baby was gone. This was not an overdose, it was a poisoning. His whole future, everything we ever wanted for him, was ripped away in an instant. And Joe Biden does nothing. I hold Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, the border czar, what a joke, and Gavin Newsom, and every Democrat who supports open borders responsible for the death of my son.
And it's a story we've heard so many times. And that's the thing about fentanyl and it's coming up, you know, it might be the ingredients coming in from China, and then how do they get it up through the southern border? And that should be an area of bipartisanship. We have the fentanyl crisis is hitting every major city in the country, some harder than others, but Democrat cities, Republican cities, Democrat areas, Republican areas. It does not discriminate based on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, rich or poor, black or white. We've seen these stories so often. So this tragedy that's unfolding in our country should be a uniting thing for us to come together to fix. Everyone is touched by it. I guarantee you, every single one of you knows someone who has either overdosed on fentanyl, died from it, had been addicted to fentanyl, because it's that prolific in our country right now. And so I think hearing from a mom and just recentering it on it, like, yeah, there's personal responsibility there. She tried to talk to her son. She talked to her son about these things. But at the end of the day, teenagers, young adults, they're going to experiment. Some of them are. And so she did all of this, and drugs still found her son. Fentanyl still found her son. And at the end of the day, if you stop the flow, if you can prevent as many of those deadly drugs from getting into our country as possible, you're going to save lives. I've already said that drug dealers, every single pill they sling, every single pill should be a count of attempted murder. Because every single pill has the potential to kill someone. So when we've got these drug busts up and down the West Coast, King County, where you've got enough doses of fentanyl to kill the entire population of King County three times over, that's someone who should never see the light of day. That's someone who is perfectly fine to make a quick buck, perfectly fine, bringing deadly drugs into our community that they knew full well would kill people. That's someone who should never see the light of day. And again, it should be a bipartisan issue. All right, let's get one Biden clip in since we're talking about the RNC so much. So I'll give it to the president. You know, he's trying to get out there and show people that he can talk still. And he's you know, able to give speeches and take questions or whatever it is. But man, he just keeps saying things that I just think he'd be better off behind closed doors. I really do. I get what they're trying to do and show that he's competent. But man, there's some doozies. Biden spoke to the NAACP. Let's listen.
The pandemic was especially devastating to Black communities. Oh, I know, because in other countries, other communities of color. That economic crisis drove up Black unemployment, decimated small Black businesses, and you peacefully protested George Floyd's murder. Donald Trump called for the National Guard to go after you. What in the hell's the matter with this man? Well, I'm serious.
Okay. I don't know what peaceful protests you watched. But I love how, like, Democrats knock Trump for not bringing in the National Guard like he should have had, you know, and although it was Pelosi's decision, right? Like, oh, for J6, it's like, you're telling me that you think that the National Guard wasn't an appropriate response to the riots of 2020? Like, did you watch any of the news? So it seems so disconnected. But also talking about what I don't know whether communities of color were hardest hit by COVID. But when you talk about economic impacts, a lot of those economic impacts were driven by Democratic governors, by Democratic leaders who shut things down, who had forced mandates that made it nearly impossible for people to earn a living. People lost jobs, people lost businesses. So you can't stand up there and talk about, and plus you were in the midst of the entirety of your first term in office, or maybe only term, was handling the pandemic. So how can you blame Donald Trump? Like, I do realize he had 2020, he had much of it, but you also had the 2021, 2022, 2023. So if there were economic impacts, I mean, you gave people quote unquote free money. You just wrote checks to Americans and tried to bribe them into supporting Democratic candidates and supporting Democrats, but you didn't fix any of the issues and you didn't call out governors who forced people into economic ruin by carrying on mandates much longer than they needed to be carried on. So just wild. All right, we'll get to questions, comments, and our closing sanity check coming up next. First, coming up next week, next Thursday, July 25th at 3 p.m., Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital is having another one of his free Know Your Risk webinars. This one is going to be about inflation. He's had a couple of these. They've been pretty popular. They call inflation the silent portfolio killer because you've got your retirement plan, you've been saving, doing everything you're supposed to do, but inflation is out of your control. So can you still afford the retirement that you have saved and planned for? That's what Zach Abraham and his team can help you figure out. They're also going to talk about the looming election, global unrest, rising cost of living, market volatility, how all of that factors into your retirement and the strength of your retirement portfolio. So protecting that retirement that you've earned has never been more critical. So don't miss Zach's special inflation webinar, July 25th at 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. Totally free to sign up. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to KnowYourRiskRadio.com. All right, questions, comments. Brown AD. Sometimes Nicole puts little notes in for the comments, and I'm like, I don't remember what that was about.
Nick Brown ad.
There it is. What? That feels like so long ago.
It does. It went all the way back. At the beginning.
Couldn't have made it more obvious. On the Nick Brown ad. Stop. So bad. Captain Cranky Pants says, these politicians know that most people don't bother to actually inform themselves. 100%. That's what they're relying on, is just making these broad generalities, you know, like Bob Ferguson, I'm sure, will do some follow-up on, oh, Reichert's tried to ban abortion nationwide 3 times. And of course, there's much more involved in that conversation. But they don't care. It's about lying, fear-mongering, gaslighting. They'll get power in any possible way they can get it, except by being honest and by being themselves. On voting and the issues of the voting, Weisscastle says, asking anyone selling alcohol how many people under 21 try to buy, even though they know they can't. Mm-hmm. I had a fake ID, okay? I had a fake ID. And I bought booze with it all the time. I went into clubs with it all the time. What are you looking at me like that? Like you didn't have a fake ID, Nicole?
I don't think I did.
Did you drink before you were 21?
Possibly. Huh. I don't know.
Interesting.
But I also live near Canada, so we just walked across the border.
Yeah.
For a couple years.
Like, look, I'll admit to it. I haven't been the perfect American. I've broken a few laws here and there. I admitted to my speeding 91 miles an hour. I do that. I'm not saying, but there are safeguards in place. Like, what happened when I sped 91 miles an hour? I got a ticket.
You did.
Okay. What happened when I went into bars using my fake ID? Well, when I was in college on Halloween, I went out to the bars under the age of 21, got a little blitzed in a Hooters waitress costume, and then I got woken up by a cop while sleeping on the couch in the common area of our dorm room in a Hooters waitress costume. He woke me up and he gave me an MIP for drinking under the age of 21.
How did he know you were drinking if you were asleep?
I'm guessing I was. It was pretty obvious. And I deserved it, you know. I paid the consequences of it. Wow, that feels good to get off my chest. And no, I don't have a picture of me in the Hooters waitress costume. But that was what I was dressing as for Halloween this year. See, if I ever run for anything, nobody has anything on me. Because I've said it all.
Admitted it all.
Right? I've admitted it all.
I think it would actually just gain you votes.
Maybe. I'll have a section on my website. You know, it has the about me, endorsements, and then there'll be one called baggage.
Yeah.
And I'll just have a whole section dedicated to my baggage.
And then that way, like,
what do you have? You have nothing on me, right? Charles says our driver's licenses aren't real ID compliant because DOL won't ask for proof of citizenship. Lots of other states have no problem doing that. And that's why I'm so curious how the state of Washington determines whether an illegal immigrant voted. Because the state under Jay Inslee, they've basically stripped it so that you can't even, like, police can't know. They've gotten rid of their ability to know whether someone's in the country illegally unless there's, like, a crime committed. It's very difficult. But, like, they don't even want it to come up. Like, they don't want it to come up in court. They don't want you to have, you can't ask for, like, a social security number. So there's all these things that they put into place to treat illegal immigrants just like the rest of us. And so I don't know, how are they going to determine, how are they determining whether illegal immigrants voted? I'm sure there's an answer. I would just like to hear it. So we'll wait.
Oh, I don't think there's an answer. I think that they're trusting they're not voting. I think that's what they're
telling us.
We're going
to find out. Because the Secretary of State's office is very good about getting back to us. So I'm sure they'll get back to us and offer us an explanation as to how we are safeguarding, as opposed to, you know, just asking for proof up front. Government can't do that. That's too simple.
I think that part of it is a cost thing, right? So they say, you know, some people can't afford to get a passport or can't afford to, well, I guess a passport's really the only thing you could do other than a birth certificate. So you'd have to, like, re-request that, or maybe you don't have access to it, or I don't know. But then make it easier to get a government ID.
But you only do it once,
too. But they're not going to not charge for that.
You only do it once. You only have to register to vote once, right? You don't have to keep re-registering. So it's just one time in your life in that state that you have to show, like, yeah, I'm a lawful permanent resident. For something as important as voting, we can't do that. Again, you have to do it to buy booze. You don't have to show you're a resident of the United States, but you have to provide identification, right? So it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Dan says, we need a notification system when your ballot is received by the state office. There is one. So you go, when you get your ballot, take the tab off the top, and there's a tracking system, and it'll track your ballot every step of the way, so you can go check, you can make sure it was received by the elections office, and then you can make sure your ballot was counted. So I use it every single time just to make sure my ballot gets to where it's going. So yeah, take the little tab off the top. Josie Manor, I have to show ID to buy Sudafed. We should show ID citizenship to vote too.
I like that.
I can't be giving away too much that Sudafed vote.
I don't call it racist to do that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Mandy, why does my passport expire, but I have to work to get it renewed? Why don't they automatically send me a new passport without asking? Because someone can impersonate me? I don't know the answer to that.
Because they want money. That's it.
They want the renewal fee. They want the renewal fee. Maxine, I like in-person voting. I feel if something is important enough to you, you will make the effort. Nicole Atwood, seems rational to me to just show your proof of citizenship. Easy peasy, 100%. Rational doesn't factor into the equation when we talk about our government, though. Brandy, the reason Democrats won't pass this bill is because they claim low-income minorities and people of color can't get identification. The problem is there are many in these groups that receive government benefits requiring proof of who you are, so it's nothing but election interference. I don't know what again, anybody is welcome to give me a rational reason why we wouldn't just show proof of American citizenship up front. That would be the easiest thing. It would save so much turmoil and hand-wringing and all of that. On the rent prices and Biden's proposal to introduce national rent control, country guy, rent control appeals to people who don't understand economics. It has not only never worked, but decreases the rental units available. Exactly. Shamalama Ding Dong says Andrew Barkus is a gem.
I really just put that comment in there because I wanted you to say his name. Shyamalan.
Yeah, Andrew Bark is a gem. I love talking to him about these things. Elijah says regulating the market is socialism. Egomorph 2 on the RNC. I like the bulldog at the RNC. I would listen to Baby Dog over Kamala any day. Did you see the cute bulldog at the RNC?
So cute.
Just sitting on stage. Bulldogs are hideous, but.
Oh my gosh,
sorry.
in the cutest way.
Listen, they're so ugly, they're cute.
Yes.
Yeah, so sorry if you have a bulldog. They're so ugly, they're cute. You just want to look at their little face.
And he just sits there like, well, I can't make that jump. I better just sit here.
He puts him on the chair up on stage.
Stop.
And you're right. He just stays there because he's like, I can't get down on my own. Let's see. Diana, of one of the moms who spoke, get that woman a cape. Matthew Cook, regarding Amber Rose, doing the work and having your mind opened is a great message. Be the party that is welcoming. I don't understand. There are some conservatives like, who's the Daily Wire guy? Not Ben.
Not Glenn.
The what's a woman guy? What is a woman? Oh my God. I'm so embarrassed. I can't think of this.
Daily Wire. Are you talking about Ben Shapiro?
Matt Walsh.
Oh.
Matt Walsh.
Oh. Okay.
He's like all losing it over Amber Rose, and that's not conservatism. Really? You don't understand how. Well, who cares? If she can convince people to vote for Donald Trump, who cares? Why are you complaining about like who the messenger is? And again, she can speak to segments of this country that will never listen to you, that will never listen to what you have to say. So why are we being picky and picky about the messenger? That makes no sense, Matt Walsh.
I have to say, especially after living in this state for the last few months, I have never seen the Republican Party more together and more at this convention. They are so unified in their messaging, and they're very, it seems very organized, and everybody seems very on the same page.
With some exceptions, Matt Gaetz like confronted Kevin McCarthy while he was doing an interview with CNN. It was just immature, but I see what you're saying, because the Republican Party has been in shambles here.
Yes.
So it's nice to see them on the national front kind of coalescing. I wish.
And like I told you earlier, I think that there hasn't really been anything. I've been watching all of the coverage from CNN and MSNBC and some of this ABC coverage. Anyway, they don't really have anything to criticize. They're having they're really struggling to criticize it. And I think that's a good thing.
I'm very curious what the ratings comparison is going to be for how many people tuned into the RNC versus how many people turn into the Democratic National Convention.
Well, I mean, not that there was ever a good timing for a assassination attempt, but it was pretty good for getting attention this week.
Yeah, for sure. All right, good comments per the usual, everyone. With that, let's get to our closing sanity check. So we'll take you back to the RNC on this one. I said one of the most effective things that I thought, you know, Amber Rose did a good job of, Melania Trump in her letter after the attempted assassination did a good job of, is focusing on former President Donald Trump's humanity, you know, because he's vilified quite a bit. Again, I think that there's a lot of criticisms of the former president that are absolutely spot on, but there has been a failure to really see his humanity and who he is as a person. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, of course, now a governor, but used to be the press secretary under Donald Trump. She told a story about Donald Trump comforting her when she was just being attacked nonstop. And I thought it really said a lot. It really personalized Donald Trump in a way that I hadn't frankly seen or thought of until this week.
My family was denied service and kicked out of a restaurant. And a parent at my 3-year-old son's preschool spit on my car. And in those moments, it was President Trump who defended me. And when an MSNBC host, the author of several books on empowering women, said I was unfit to be a mother, and another MSNBC host said I was vile, not even human, and that I should be choked, MSNBC again did nothing. But our president pulled me aside, looked me in the eye and said, Sarah, you're smart, you're beautiful, you're tough, and they attack you because you're good at your job. Never let them stop fighting. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Yeah, it's the things that people do and say behind the scenes that tell you the most about who they really are. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here, and thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We got one more live show this week coming at you. We'll have some great local and national content tomorrow as we look forward to the president, former president, giving his speech at the RNC tomorrow evening. If you have not signed up to support the show already, please do so. It's just $5 a month to support the work we're doing. You can sign up at undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. And while you're there, you can shop our merch store. Get 25% off our Common Sense collection using the promo code SANITY24. That's sanity and the number of number 24. See you tomorrow back here at noon. Boop, ba-doop, ba-doop.